Thanks, folks. We're going to have a Q&A session here right now.
Questions for Mr. Hoover.
I see you have T-34s out here. Did you have any experience with T-34s?
No, unfortunately, I did not. And I've flown one, of course, but I didn't put much time in it. But it is a great airplane, and it's pretty obvious that it it was a very important airplane for its purpose. And it's the beginning for so many aviators, and it's an introduction to the real flying that comes along with the other military aircraft. So it was a very successful project.
Next question.
Bob, what was your favorite airplane to fly?
Probably the F-86. I was one of the principal test pilots on the airplane, and I only lost one airplane in that program. I might describe to you how I lost that airplane. We were using an F-86 as a test bed for some of the theories that we had about how could we have good controllability if we were able to design and build an airplane that could go supersonic in level flight. And that was to be the F-100. And so they had done the wind tunnel test and tried to figure out the best location for the horizontal stabilizer for the most efficiency in controlling the airplane at supersonic speeds. And I had been on the compressibility program, which I had gotten an enormous education before Chuck Yeager came on board, and who did a magnificent job, incidentally. But I'd been selected for that because on one project I had working on compressibility, which is the airflow breakdown that kept us from ever going supersonic in those early days. And it had to do with the shape of the airfoil, a whole bunch of interferences, where the wing is connected to the fuselage, where the airflow burbles, shakes, suddenly the airplane starts coming unglued. And of course, in the flight test work before computers, and we didn't have computers in those days, the first thing that would happen would be maybe you'd lose a trim tab, and then the next thing would go with it, would be an aileron, and then the next thing would be part of your tail. And then the next thing is you're raining down in pieces or else you're dead. And we were using a P-47 to do this compressibility testing. And they had an electric motor operating a device that we had put on the airplanes. Kind of complicated. I won't bore you with these details. But it was put on the horizontal stabilizer right at the hinge point on in front of the elevators. And that was to break down the airflow that was smooth it out, supposedly. And I said, I don't want an electric motor. I believe that's what killed old Charlie, and I think I'd have a better chance if you'd give me a manual control thing that I could telescope a rod from the floor and have it in ratchets so I could just pull so much each time and get so much deflection and so much change of airflow instead of getting it all at once. And so I was doing this. But it went all the way up to the canopy. And I can't raise my arm because of one of my accidents. I broke both shoulders. But it was such that I'd go right up to the top of the canopy there. And I could pull it back like this a little bit at a time and go one ratchet at a time. And there I'd get a smooth breakdown of airflow or change of airflow. And everything was going along fine. And then all of a sudden, I heard the loudest explosion I'd ever heard, and I was unconscious. When I came to, I was about 12 or 13,000 feet, and the airplane was flying along. The engine was sounding good, and I looked down. The instrument panel was down on my ankles, and the wings were bent up about like that on each side. And what happened? The airplane had overheated. This is what happened at Reno a couple of years ago. He went right through blackout stage. I mean, it was such an impact the high G forces were so great that he was rendered unconscious, and he never gained consciousness before he hit the ground. And in my case, I would have gone in, but the airplane was trimmed just right. And when I came to and I was looking around, I looked at those wings, and they were corrugated, looked like corrugated on a tin roof, you know, just ripping. But the wings had bent up so much that it pulled the up blocks loose, or that hold the landing gear into the wings. And because of that, the gear came out, and when the gear came out, the gear doors came off, and one of the doors hit part of the tail. And so now I had, on one side, no tail, but the airplane was fine. The engine was running good, but everything was on down on my ankles. And when I cleared up, my chase pilot, who was later killed, a good friend of mine, he was in a P-80, so he could fly at about 8/10, and I was seeking 0.83, and that's what I got, was 0.83. And it was the whole shape of the airfoil was the reason we couldn't go any faster. It was an airflow breakdown over the controlled surfaces and the intersections of all of the parts of the airplane to go to the fuselage. But it was an interesting program, and I survived it, and we learned an awful lot from that. And then I was selected for the X-1 program, and I was asked by a friend of mine who wasn't flying jets, fly over the Springfield Airport the first chance you get with a jet, and I'll tell them it was me. That's mistake number one. And so I said, well, you know, Pete, I don't have enough fuel. Every time I fly a jet, I use up every ounce of fuel gathering data. And I said, I plan for a dead stick landing on every flight I make because I'm trying to get the most data out of the amount of fuel I have on board each flight. And if I ever get a chance, I'll do it. Well, this one day I took off, and the weather was where I had to fly to get the smooth air. It was over Lake St. Mary up there in Ohio, and it was too rough. I couldn't get the data. And the data, before computers, you had to have it accurate to know whether you had real data or a bum data. It had to plot well on the charts. And you did that with slide rules. Nevertheless, I had the no sense I'm wasting my time trying to record it. So I came back and I had a lot of fuel, and that was a Springfield Airport underneath. I'll just make a trip across the upside down. I did. The numbers on the side of the airplane were small, and I never thought anything about it. 2 months went by, and I was elated about being selected for the X-1 program. And a new colonel came in, and he said, I just got a letter here saying that somebody buzzed the Springfield Airport on such and such a date. Was that you? I said, yes, sir, it was. He said, well, I know two things about you. You're honest because there was only one jet that flew in the whole United States that day, and you were in it. But I also know that you're not responsible. And I don't know who I'm going to select. You've got so much knowledge that nobody else has. I've been working with the Germans who had built their jets and tested them. And so I did have a wealth of accumulated information. And he said, you're going to help him out. You're going to live with him. You're going to fly with him. You're going to be his backup pilot. And I thought, oh, boy. You know, there were 16 people in that pyramid of candidates to get to that peak I had made. And now I've lost it all. And I just thought, oh, I don't think some of those guys had the guts to ever do what I've done. And I know they didn't. Well, he called me in 2 months later, and he said, did you ever hear of a Captain Yeager? I said, yes, sir. He said, you're going to be his backup. I'm selecting him. Well, Chuck hadn't even been to the test pilot school. But I'll tell you, he was about as hot a fighter pilot as you could ever hope to see. And he didn't have anybody as competition. The two of us, we flew all of the, not all of them, but most of the captured German and Japanese airplanes and evaluated them against one another from a combat tactical viewpoint, trying to see if we could glean any information from our enemy airplanes that could be helpful for our future designs with our jet airplanes. And we found some things, and the Germans were ahead of everybody else in a lot of ways. But Chuck was good. I tell you, we fought in every kind of an airplane you could imagine. No one could have done a better job than he did. I was heartbroken at first, but because I retired, I just thought he was so great, and he really was great. It's like my friend Bud Anderson, the two of them flew together during the war, and both were very successful in their combat careers. And Bud has been one of my heroes ever since. Triple ace, and every fighter pilot's dream was to get 5 kills. I never made the grade, but boy, my heart was with them, and they deserve every accolade they will ever get.
That that day, October 14, 1947, when Chuck broke the sound barrier for the first time, of course, Bob was flying Chase. When you look at that picture of the Bell XS-1 going through the sound barrier with all those little diamonds, Bob's a photographer. He took that picture, which, of course, is history.
And Bob, what can we say? You are the pilot's pilot. Thank you very much, Bob.